Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
A popular institution in Hollywood saved by shuttle diplomacy. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. After 3 years of increasingly passionate argument, the beloved Hollywood Farmers Market has worked out a deal with the LA Film School. Also tonight, environmentalists are hailing the State Fish and Game Commission for protecting the California coastline, but some fishermen are still unhappy. And competitors are arguing over designs for two possible NFL stadiums with no guarantee from the NFL that it wants to come back to L.A. Later on, more confusion about Afghanistan. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. President Obama said today that gains in Afghanistan are fragile but real. We'll have more later on the much-awaited White House review. First, a follow-up on our program on Monday about the Hollywood Farmers Market. That's a 19-year-old institution beloved by celebrities and natural foodies alike. Between Sunset and Hollywood Boulevards, it adjoins property owned by the L.A. Film School, which has complained for years that the market interferes with parking for classes on Sunday. The market lies in the City Council District of Eric Garcetti, and today he conducted shuttle diplomacy. Good to have you on our program, Councilman.
Great to be with you, Warren.
When we talked on Monday, the solutions ranged from moving the market completely to knocking a hole in a parking lot wall at the L.A. Film School. Were you able to resolve this dispute?
We had a great meeting, and I think that we have taken steps that are very close to resolving this entire issue. The people's access to fruit and vegetables on Ivar Street in Hollywood is alive and well, and the farmers market is not going to leave Hollywood. It is not going to shut down. And none of the other farmers markets run by the organization Sustainable Economic Enterprises of Los Angeles in other neighborhoods are going to be shut down either. So that's very good news. Both sides recognize a need to work out a very solvable problem and protect the farmers market in Hollywood. And it was music to my ears. I was happy to play a role to bring those sides together, and we're just going to work on some of the final language in the next 24 hours.
Well, is the LA Film School going to have to knock a hole in the wall?
That's one of the things we're going to look at. We're going to see, you know, is that the best use of taxpayer money or private money to, it's less than a hole in a wall. It's actually two structures that don't quite touch on two different levels. So building a cement ramp could be quite expensive, but I want to exhaust that. And if that's possible, let's get it done and keep the same footprint. If not, let's keep the market where it is for the most part, and then maybe shift a half of a block or a block of it to another abutting street. Take this as an opportunity to even expand the market, which is, you know, bursting at the seams. It's so popular, but to make sure it doesn't leave Hollywood because it's been such a critical part of its comeback.
There's conceivably taxpayer money involved?
Well, you know, we have taxpayer money that subsidizes our farmers markets every weekend with the street closures, and we provide community development block grant monies from the federal government, and we've done things like build the parking structure next to it. I just offered that, here's an employer that's employing people locally, a farmers market that employs people and produces amazing, healthy food for everybody, that we'll look at how much it would cost to do something like that. I'd prefer, obviously, if that's a solution, that the business itself do it, but we're willing to play a role and see if we might be able to help them.
This has been an extraordinarily passionate dispute. There have been death threats on at least one side.
Yes, that's why it was so important for me to get personally involved from this. My office has been involved for many months, but I wanted to personally meet with both sides and say, what can we do to dial down the rhetoric, the legal approaches, and to really ramp up the neighborhood solutions? Because we all love what Hollywood has turned into, a place where on the weekend you can see your neighbor, get good produce and food, see students that are there. With 20,000 students, Warren, that now live and go to school in the Hollywood area, and that helps keep it safe, helps sustain businesses. And so I really was confident there was a win-win. There are plenty of peace processes that are much more complicated than this one, and I was really pleased to see folks acting like Angelenos today instead of enemies.
How important to the revival of Hollywood is the LA Film School?
You know, it's been a important part of it. I think Hollywood for a long time left Hollywood. And what do I mean by that? The entertainment industry wasn't there in the heart of what made that neighborhood so famous. So whether it's the film school coming back or studio space being built back there, Jimmy Kimmel coming to Hollywood Boulevard, I've tried to make it a place where the most creative people in the world feel welcome to study and to produce things. And, you know, for me, that's why it's so critical, especially in an economic downturn, to make sure that those farmers and vendors at the market can continue to have livelihood, but that also folks who are going to contribute to one of our key industries can also get that training, and the teachers who teach them have those jobs.
Okay, so it appears that the market has been saved. Eric Garcetti, city councilman in Hollywood, not telling us exactly what the terms are as yet. Councilman, if you can, stay with us for a moment. I want to introduce Evan Kleiman, who is a chef and owner of Angeli Cafe. She's host of KCRW's Good Food, and she's also a member of the Los Angeles Food Policy Task Force. Evan, good to have you on our show.
Thank you, Warren.
How important is this, do you think, to you and others involved with the LA Food Policy Task Force?
Well, I think it's massively important that healthy, thriving farmers markets feel secure and they know that they're going to get to stay where they're going to be for a good long time. You know, people sometimes say, oh, we'll just move a couple stands, move a couple tables, but I don't think they realize the huge amount of infrastructure involved in creating a market and making sure that it's safe and accessible to all who want to come and buy.
What do you know about the details of the agreement that apparently has been worked out?
Well, I think that what happened today was a good faith acknowledgement that both sides want the same thing and that steps are going to be taken within a reasonable time frame to come to some kind of accommodation so that both sides can continue to thrive and serve their different customer bases.
Steps are going to be taken. You sound like a politician. In fact, you sound like the politician that's on the other end of the line here.
Well, but, you know, this is the kind of thing where you're talking about streets. And so anytime you're talking about streets, there are so many different solutions. My understanding is that Councilman Garcetti's offices have received suggestions from sort of Los Angelinos acting as independent consultants on their own. So I think so many possibilities that can happen to accommodate the market, which is experiencing growing pains, you know, that there really is nothing to report today except for the fact that an agreement that everyone wants to go in the same direction.
So, Eric Garcetti, back to you. Everybody's tiptoeing around the details. I assume that's because this has been going on for so long, and it has been so contentious that there's concern that if the wrong detail leaks, everything might fall apart.
It's not that delicate, actually. I just wanted to respect the confidentiality of going to both parties and talking to them privately. I can say that they do want the same thing, and I can give you more details, and that I think we will see tomorrow, but I want to give people the time to write these words down themselves and send it to each other, that there's a promise from the city that the farmers market will stay in Hollywood, that it will be centered around Selma and Ivar, where it is, unless the farmers market at a future date sees its expansion moving it to a different place, but they won't be forced to. But that this business will also get promised to have access to all of its parking for its expansion and its jobs and education that it provides. When both sides recognize that, I think that allows us as the city then to say, okay, what do we have to do? Either there will be some way of making these two parking lots become one, or part of the current footprint will be slightly altered, but not moved away, to be able to accommodate just as many farmers, just as many great places to get food. And perhaps this is a great opportunity for us to expand that footprint. You know, I'd love a better place to sit down and eat some of the great food that I get there on Sundays. I'd like to see us, you know, do more education classes and opportunities for health and some of the other things we do at the Farmer's Kitchen during the week, which is the permanent part that I helped build with the farmer's market there in Hollywood. So it's really an opportunity. While it might have been a lot of shouting, channeling that energy into something that expands our healthy food access and jobs in Hollywood is ultimately what I think we're going to see come out of this.
Well, City Councilman Eric Garcetti, thanks a lot for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Evan Kleiman, thanks to you as well. I gather that 8,000 to 10,000 people now are still going to be able to go to the farmers market on Sundays.
Oh, yeah, and isn't that wonderful?
Thanks again to you.
Thank you, Warren.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Yesterday, the State Fish and Game Commission approved 34 ocean habitat reserves off the coast of California from Point Conception to the Mexican border. The majority vote was a bare 3-2 after a five-hour meeting attended by hundreds of people in Santa Barbara. It came after years of contentious meetings between more than 60 stakeholders. Some pristine waters will still be open to fishing, but many others will not. Mark Gold is executive director of Heal the Bay. Mark Gold, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be here.
Tell us, if you will, what the effect of this will be. I gather you're very happy.
I think relieved more than anything else, but obviously the Marine Life Protection Act, which was legislation that passed about a decade ago, it's taken a long time to get to that point where you're starting to see a network of marine protected areas along the coast of California to really manage them much, much better. And so some of these areas that are set aside are no-take zones, and some of them are limited take zones that might allow sport fishing and no commercial fishing or certain types of gear. To really protect it. But it's something that's a long time coming. They've been successful all around the world, and California, once again, is a leader environmentally in the United States in trying to move forward in this sort of progressive protection of our coastal resources.
Why is it so important?
Well, it's important because we've seen, unfortunately, the state of many of our coastal ecosystems isn't what it once was 30, 40, 50 years ago. And in essence, we're sort of loving some of these coastal resources to death. A lot of people love fishing, and so there's been not is effective management of a number of different species over the years. And what we're really not seeing is many big fish. And as much biodiversity as maybe we did 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's been many, many research papers that have been done on this over the years that show that marine protected areas really do make a big difference when it comes to biodiversity and the size and productivity of fish.
Mark Gold, again, executive director of Heal the Bay. Alex Masumoto is a member of the United Anglers of Southern California, and he's owner of the Rusty Hook. That's a tackle shop in San Pedro. Alex Masumoto, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me on.
We're in the midst of a recession, and I take it that's one of the things that concerned you about this. How's this going to affect your business?
Well, I mean, with the recession and people out of work, we've seen a significant drop in sales over the last 2 years. And with this MLPA closure coming in, it'll be coming in the middle of our season, so it's not going to impact it until later in the year when things are slow. But yeah, we're expecting probably another 20% decrease in our sales at bare minimum. Some guys have said up to 40%, but I'm more conservative, and I'd say probably 20%. But you know, with the economy being what it is, you know, we're barely scraping by right now, and to have these areas taken out, it couldn't happen at a worse time.
Well, other areas, though, are open. Why do you necessarily think your clients won't go where they can?
Well, in my particular area of this South Coast region, it didn't hit us as hard because they left Rocky Point open. I know Mark's group really wanted Rocky Point badly, but to allow the city of Redondo Beach to have an area where their constituents could fish, it was strongly urged, to say the least, that they move the boundary to Point Vincennes. And Point Vincennes is a pretty long run from San Pedro. And, you know, some of my guys fish there, but most don't. The commercial lobster fleet is going to be hit especially hard because that is a prime area for their lobster traps. And Point Doom got taken. What was that? Point Conception. Those were all very, very productive areas for the commercial lobster fleet. And so most of those guys are going to be pushed into other areas, so they're going to be more highly concentrated, and a lot of guys probably will just go out of business. But, you know, hopefully it doesn't come to that. And I was talking to one of my vendors in San Diego, and the La Jolla closure is really going to hurt them down there.
Alex Masumoto, again, with the United Anglers of Southern California and owner of the Rusty Hook in San Pedro. Mark Gold, back to you with Heal the Bay. What about the economic consequences? Is that something that people like Alex Masumoto are just going to have to live with?
You know, it's been talked about a lot, and the issue really boils down to is, do you think marine protected areas are going to work or not? And in other parts of the world, as well as in our own Channel Islands, we haven't seen the tremendous economic negative impacts that a lot of the fishing community was very worried about. At the same time, you know, economics really went into this analysis as well, that no one's going to say that the final marine protected area network for Southern California meets science guidelines. It doesn't in many places. And a lot of that is some of the economic arguments. I think Alex and his colleagues did a very, very strong and effective job of protecting some of the most popular sport fishing spots on both Catalina as well as Rocky Point in Santa Monica Bay. So those are just two major examples here in Los Angeles County where very big compromises were made because of these economic arguments. So this is not exactly the perfect network, MPA network for protection of biodiversity, but it's definitely a compromise there's something in there for everyone, but there's also something in there for everyone to get upset about as well. But by and large, at least we finally have a network in place, and we can allow the ecosystems to recover without getting hammered continuously.
Alex Masumoto, if in fact species are being depleted and the size of fish available is going down, doesn't that hurt your business too, especially in the long run?
Yes, it does, and to a certain extent, but a lot has to do with the water conditions. Obviously, and Mark knows more about this than I do, the amount of pollution that goes into the ocean every day is one of the major factors in fish populations going down. Sport fishing doesn't put a dent in it. Commercial fishing, depending on species, can really impact them. And, you know, with the gill nets being pushed out to 3 miles, we've seen a huge increase in the number of white sea bass caught, and also halibut. And that's one of the things that, you know, part of the traditional fisheries management that has helped greatly. Also, the hatchery program that Scripps is doing for the white sea bass, they're also working on halibut and calico bass hatchery programs. So, you know, we're doing on our end as much as we can, you know, the closures, they're law, so we have to live with them. We don't have to like them, and I'm sure Mark doesn't either, but we just have to do what we can with what we're dealt, and hopefully it doesn't put us so far out that we have to go out of business. But
Mark Gold, very quickly, because we're running short of time, how actually does this work? How are these networks managed?
I think the management is going to be one of the big issues, because you have a fishing game department that is grossly underfunded. And so, to be quite candid, there's a big concern on how well there's really going to be enforcement because of lack of resources there. So there's going to probably be a lot of volunteer involvement and just relying on the fishing community to do the right thing. And one last thing is, you know, I'm really excited, hopefully, that this is largely behind us so we can go back to being natural allies with the sport fishing community, because it just doesn't make sense, since we both do agree that we got pollution problems. We have once through cooling power plant problems sucking the life out of the ocean, and we really should be natural allies in protecting coastal resources.
Alex Masumoto, is it possible you guys could shake hands again?
Oh, absolutely. I respect Mark's work and his organization. We come to, you know, we bump heads on a few issues as far as these closures go, but like I said, you know, we have to live with what's dealt to us, and you know, like I say, hopefully it won't put us out of business. You know, the pollution obviously is a huge issue, and I don't know how that's ever going to get settled.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you both for being with us. Alex Masumoto, again, the owner of the Rusty Hook Tackle Shop in San Pedro, member of the United Anglers of Southern California. Mark Gold, executive director of Heal the Bay. Good to have you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Norman Olney back with Which Way LA. Today's local newspaper showed three alternate renderings of a football stadium that might be located next to the convention center in downtown LA. Then again, it might not. If it were, it would be built by Anschutz Entertainment, which owns Staples Center, but there's competition with another side in the City of Industry. Then again, the National Football League is a long way from deciding to return to Los Angeles. Vincent Bonsignori writes about sports for the Daily News. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So both of these competing sites have generated architectural renderings of competitive stadiums. How likely are they ever to get built?
I think one is very likely at some point. You know, and right now it looks like the proposal downtown, which is being spearheaded by Tim Leiwicki and AEG, which built the Staples Center and LA Live. I think that one has the momentum going for them. The one in City of Industry, which is backed by billionaire Ed Roskey Jr. and Majestic Realty, is, you know, in football terms, probably about 30 yards ahead of AEG's plan. They're ready, shovel ready. They've got all the OKs. Everything has been submitted and approved, and they have the financing. They're just waiting for a team to say that they want to come out and play there. But the problem with that is the NFL is in a labor stalemate at this point, and they're not going to do any business until their collective bargaining agreement between the owners and players gets rectified, and that might take a little while, and it's allowing AEG to catch up, so to speak, and gain more momentum. So, but out of one of those two, one of them will get a stadium and one of them will get a team, and we'll have football here in Los Angeles, I would say, 2013, maybe 2014, right around then.
Who makes the ultimate decision?
Well, it's going to be the NFL's decision ultimately, and it's going to be a team is going to have to agree to come here and play. Which you know, behind the scenes, the NFL desperately wants to get back to Los Angeles, and there's a group of about 5 to 6 teams that are in fights for of their lives in their current cities, trying to get new stadiums there. And you know, out of that 5 or 6, I would say one, maybe even two, would be in a position where they have no other choice but to move to Los Angeles. So, you know, I think it's pretty likely, and I think that, you know, the NFL will make the call when they're ready to make the call, though.
One thing that the NFL teams typically have done is to get a lot of public subsidies for stadiums in various different places. And in some cases, that has led to a sort of a white elephant situation where they've got a stadium in the middle of town, but they only have 6 or 8 games a year, and it's not good for much else. And a lot of public money goes down the tubes. Are they trying to avoid that here in L.A.?
Yeah, both projects have been, you know, what we're being told is that they're going to be privately funded. A billion-dollar project by the AEG people downtown, which also includes, it does include $300 million worth of bonds to repair the LA Convention Center, because they're going to have to tear down the West Hall and then redo it. And there are bonds on that property. However, AEG has vowed to repay it if it doesn't get repaid, you know, through the extra taxes that are generated in that area. So technically there is some public money, but they're saying that they've got it, they're going to cover it, so it won't come out of the city's pockets. And the Majestic proposal in City of Industry is 100% privately funded. So that's what gives Los Angeles a leg up on some of these other cities. All these other cities that we're talking about, and we're talking about Minnesota and St. Louis, Jacksonville, Buffalo, San Francisco, Oakland, and San Diego, all of their stadium proposals need public financing to help it along. In Los Angeles, we have two groups that have stated we don't need anybody's money, we could build it ourselves, and that's a huge aspect. An asset in Los Angeles' favor.
Kind of ironic that both Oakland and St. Louis have been here before.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, one will be definitely coming home in the Rams' case, and if they are the team. And the Raiders, you know, spent a few years here, but they obviously started in Oakland. But they may do. They may come back. There is a lot of talk that the Raiders might be the team. Although the team to really keep an eye on is the San Diego Chargers.
The San Diego
Ironically
Chargers.
Enough, they started in Los Angeles. They played their first year in Los Angeles in 1960.
Okay, so there are a lot of ironies at work here in this situation. As you indicate, though, Broski is a billionaire. He's not going to take this easily, and the City of Industry is going to try to compete as well, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a lot at stake here. You know, and you have to give Broski credit because he's kept Los Angeles in the forefront these last few years with his proposal. And it just so happens, though, that they got to a point where now there's a stalemate and there's a lull, and it's allowed the AEG group to catch up a little bit. But you know, they've done business before. Let's face it. You know, Ed Roski helped build Staples Center. He owns a part of the Kings, just like AEG does. He's got a big stake in LA Live. These two companies do business in other ventures. They just so happen to be on opposite ends of the aisle on this one, but. Who knows? Maybe they'll join up at some point in one unified force.
Well, thank you so much for giving us the history and the background.
You got it.
Vincent Buonsignore, who is a columnist, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Daily News. Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, more confusion about Afghanistan on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. After the much-awaited White House review, President Obama said today that gains in Afghanistan are fragile but real. He still hopes to begin a so-called conditions-based withdrawal in July of next year.
We are moving toward a new phase in Afghanistan, a transition to full Afghan lead for security that will begin early next year and will conclude in 2014.
Again, the president speaking today at the White House. Julian Barnes is Pentagon reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Julian, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
New phase, concluding with the combat in 2014. Is that a big change from past policy?
Well, you know, this review didn't get into the real details of what this mission is going to look like later this year. That transition point the president was talking about begins in July when the drawdown starts. Now, at the press conference today, Mr. Gates was asked how fast that drawdown was going to be. He declined to answer. So we don't know exactly what that transition period is going to look like.
The president said today that the U.S. will be relentless in achieving its goals. So what are those goals?
From the start, I've been very clear about our core goal. It's not to defeat every last threat to the security of Afghanistan, because ultimately it is Afghans who must secure their country. And it's not nation building, because it is Afghans who must build their nation. Rather, we are focused on disrupting, dismantling, and defeating Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's no more Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, is there, Julian Barnes?
Not really. You can. There may be, at any given time, there may be a stray dozen or so Al-Qaeda fighters. It is not a large number. They do remain in Pakistan. They're not in Afghanistan.
So that's really then the focus, even though the president doesn't quite say that.
Yeah, I mean, you've hit upon an interesting thing. The logic of the White House is to prevent Al-Qaeda from coming back into Afghanistan, we must prevent the Taliban from retaking power. And therefore, what we're doing in Afghanistan is focused on Al-Qaeda. But it is interesting. The president always talks about Al-Qaeda. He does not talk about the Taliban. The military almost always talks about the Taliban.
Okay. Again, Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, as always, for being with us.
Thank you.
While the Pentagon has emphasized progress since the president escalated the war last December, America's combined intelligence agencies tell a different story, emphasizing especially the failure of Pakistan to shut down Taliban sanctuaries across the Afghan border. Here again, President Obama.
We've welcomed major Pakistani offensives in the tribal regions. We will continue to help strengthen Pakistan's capacity to root out terrorists. Nevertheless, progress has not come fast enough. So we will continue to insist to Pakistani leaders that terrorist safe havens within their borders must be dealt with.
Carolyn Wadhams is with the Liberal Center for American Progress. She is the lead author of a report called Realignment, Managing a Stable Transition to Afghan Responsibility. Carolyn Wadhams, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit more, if you will, about what the combined intelligence agencies have reported, because it's a good deal less optimistic than what the White House Review had to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main points coming out of that those leaked intelligence assessments, although I haven't been able to see a classified the classified document, but news reports indicate that what they're pointing to is really the continued sanctuaries for Afghan insurgents within Pakistan, and that until we can effectively deal with those sanctuaries, then it will be very difficult to defeat this insurgency in Afghanistan. That was I think one of the primary points. Another thing that it pointed to was just about the fragility of the gains made against the Taliban. And concerns about the insurgency actually spreading throughout the country.
The president himself said that the progress was frail. You just said the fragility of the gains. So does he appear to have picked up at least part of what the intelligence agencies had to say?
I think that this assessment, the president's assessment, definitely has some of it. It raises some of the same concerns as the intelligence agencies. This document, the review has a little bit more of a positive spin, but a lot of the challenges are acknowledged in both documents, just in terms of Pakistan and in terms of, you know, the review talks a lot about some of the progress that's been made, but there, if you look at the document, they're always qualified. It's a limited progress. It's potentially reversible. It's fragile. So there are a lot of qualifications even for the claims they're making about progress.
To what extent is the Obama White House itself divided about what ought to be done with regard to Afghanistan?
I think they're actually quite divided, and a lot of the debates that we saw in the review months ago, over a year ago, and then which were revealed again in the Bob Woodward book, I don't think a lot of those issues have been resolved. And you hear, even talking to people within the administration, that there is disagreement, I think, among people within the Department of Defense and within the U.S. military, and the White House, State Department, USAID, who have different assessments of how well the U.S. strategy is actually working. There are, I think, major concerns from what I've heard in the White House about just about the sustainability of these gains, and which are acknowledged in this assessment.
Again, Caroline Williams is with the Center for American Progress. Stephen Biddle is Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. He's a former associate professor at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Stephen Biddle, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What would you say about victory and defeat in the Afghanistan situation? When the president lays out his goal, does it sound like what most Americans think of as victory?
Well, I think Americans tend to have a binary view of victory and defeat. Victory is, you know, ticker tape parades and signing ceremonies on battleship decks. You know, defeat is the opposite. Most wars don't end that way, though. World War II is in some ways an anomaly. By and large, wars end in negotiated settlements of some kind. They can be settlements that favor one side substantially relative to the other, but there's usually some kind of negotiation that produces a deal. That will almost certainly be the case here as well. What the war is really about between now and then is over what will the terms of the settlement be. But when we continue to use even terms like success and failure, which is a much weaker formulation than victory and defeat, we still tend to think in terms of destroying the enemy or somehow evicting them from the theater operations. And I doubt that's what's going to happen here, and I think the strategy is oriented towards producing a kind of a settlement we can live with rather than some annihilation of the Taliban.
Caroline Wadhams, back to you. Once again, Secretary Clinton and the president himself made reference to the late Richard Holbrooke, who was the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Did his role and the difficulty he appeared to have in playing it reflect some ambiguity, if that's the right term, with regard to American strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you saw that with Ambassador Holbrooke that, you know, it was never clear what exactly his role was and what he was actually in charge of within the portfolio. There's been, I think, more confusion on the civilian side about who's actually in charge of that strategy, despite the fact that it's probably the most important element of the strategy. And you've seen, I think, just how dominant the U.S. military and General Petraeus himself has been within, you know, as being the sort of the more of the public face of this strategy. Ambassador Holbrooke, I think, went into that job expecting that he would have much more control over resources and ability to appoint people and to really drive the strategy. And I think because of sort of the marginalization of civilians generally within this strategy and probably confusion over what the actual end game is, he was, I think, given a less prominent role.
Stephen Biddle, the president said today that the goal is not nation building. What about the civilian aspect of this? How important is it, and what is it doing?
Well, all the way back to the infamous McChrystal assessment report, the military in particular has said that co-equally necessary for success is governance reform, not just improvement on the ground in security. There's a tendency to assume that when people say you need governance reform, that that's the civilian side of things. That's their job. I think actually the reason why the McChrystal military assessment included governance reform as being so central is because it's as much a military job as it is a civilian job. I mean, it's important that we get more civilian advisors into the country to help with economic development, to assist Afghans in improving the technical parts of running the government. But at least as important to getting improvement in governance is having the military campaign be run in a way that doesn't contribute to the problem of malign, predatory governance in Afghanistan that in many ways is really the central challenge to governance success. The civilian surge notion tends to imply that the problem with governance in Afghanistan is they don't have enough trained civilian administrators, they don't have enough people who can run agricultural extension operations and so on. And therefore sending more American civilians to Afghanistan is the way to make things better. I actually think the real problem with governance in Afghanistan is not that a government that theoretically wants the right thing just doesn't have enough wherewithal and resources to do it right. I think the real problem with governance in Afghanistan is that too much of the Afghan government wants the wrong thing. They're engaged in actively preying upon the population they're supposed to be governing. To fix that problem requires a much broader change in the way we do business than just parachuting into Afghanistan another 1,000 or another 2,000 civilian experts in various technical aspects of life in Afghanistan.
Stephen Biddle again with the Council on Foreign Relations. Caroline Wadhams, back to you with the Center for American Progress, a liberal organization, presumably somewhat supportive of the president. But do you feel he's dropped the ball in terms of Afghanistan in the way that Stephen Biddle suggests perhaps he has?
Yeah, I think there are major problems that exist in this strategy. I mean, first of all, there's a problem with the Obama administration still hasn't figured out what our end state is in Afghanistan. They have not been able to effectively link how the overarching goal of defeating al-Qaeda, preventing its return from Afghanistan, how you link up what we're doing in Afghanistan to that bigger goal. What is good enough so that you can prevent al-Qaeda from returning to Afghanistan if that's the overall objective? You know, I thought it was really interesting today in the press briefing, Secretary of Defense Gates said at one point, you know, we've got to keep our objectives have to be minimal. We can't do it all in Afghanistan. Then he went on to say that, you know, in order to have stability, we need to be able to create security, dispute resolution, and have health clinics within an hour of walking distance. in every district in Afghanistan. I mean, there is such confusion about what we're trying to achieve. And I think, you know, there has been some limited progress within specific areas of Afghanistan, especially in Kandahar and Helmand. But the issue is whether that actually gets you closer to the end state, which is not clear at this point. I mean, how does if the goal is to you know, be able to get out of Afghanistan without it falling into civil war and having it be a vacuum, we're not getting, there's no progress in any of those fundamental issues which are related to governance, political exclusion, and the safe haven in Pakistan. We're not getting any closer to achieving those objectives.
Stephen Biddle, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with much of it, but not all of it. I think the administration does need to be clearer, both with the public, but also internally, on what our war aims are. I mean, what political outcome in Afghanistan can we live with and are willing to fight to produce? What outcomes can we not live with? With respect to whether progress is being made on the governance front, though, I think progress is being made, but it's slow and it's hard to observe, in part because there's a change in conceptualization going on in Afghanistan about what the governance problem is. For a long, long time in Afghanistan, and in our doctrine for counterinsurgency generally, we tended to look at governance the way I described earlier. It's a problem of building up the capacity of a putatively benign host government. I think we've increasingly come to recognize that that's not the problem in Afghanistan and have been shifting to a conception of what we need to do about governance in the country that's oriented towards disempowering networks of malign actors within the government who are currently empowered, importantly, by contract money that we are spending in the country that they redirect, skim, and put to the purposes of the construction of patronage networks that enable them to then turn and prey on the population they're nominally going to serve. As we've shifted focus, it's set up a new set of requirements for things we have to do that we had not been doing. Especially, we have to redirect our own intelligence services to understanding how our money is being misused, who the key bad actors are, what companies and what contracts are being used to redirect funds. Once we know that, we can then start to cancel contracts, change the way we spend money and do business, and start the process of weakening these networks. It's interesting that we recently, for example, blacklisted Watan Risk Management, which is one of the more prominent of the corporate entities in southern Afghanistan that have been used to redirect American money to the operation of a predatory government network in Kandahar province. That's suggestive that we're doing some of this homework and we're starting to make some changes and we're starting to have some traction. It's harder to observe than changes in security. It's harder to publicize than the ability to walk through Argandab or Panjwa outside Kandahar, whereas you couldn't do that a year ago. It is progress, though. It is important, but it's fairly early in the process of this kind of redesign of the governance campaign.
Stephen Biddle with the Council on Foreign Relations. As President Obama discussed the review of strategy in Afghanistan, today's Washington Post revealed a new survey showing that a record 60% of Americans don't think America's longest war has been worth fighting. Today, the president reflected on the sacrifices that U.S. troops are making, and he called for civilian support.
We're going to have to continue to stand up. We'll continue to give our brave troops and civilians the strategy and resources they need to succeed. We will never waver from our goal of disrupting, dismantling, and ultimately defeating al-Qaeda. We will forge enduring partnerships with people who are committed to progress and to peace. And we will continue to do everything in our power to ensure the security and the safety of the American people.
David Korn is Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, a liberal organization. He's also a columnist at PoliticsDaily.com. And David, it's always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Of course, all Americans are in favor of the troops that are sent into harm's way. But what about support for the war itself? Do you think that what the president said today and the information that came from the review is going to lead particularly the Democratic base to be any more supportive than it has been?
I don't think anything today will change the politics facing the president on this very challenging issue of the Afghanistan war. You know, looking at the polls over the course of the last few years, it's roughly half the country is opposed to the war. Sometimes the number is higher, sometimes it's lower, and half the country say they support it. But more importantly, I think most of the country is disengaged on the war. If you watch a lot of media, as I know I do, you don't see a lot of references to the war. It's not on a lot of front pages of local newspapers. The Times and the Post, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, major newspapers still try to cover it. But even in those pages, you can sometimes go a week or two without seeing a major story on what's happening with the war. So the polls, I think, reflect the fact that people would rather not even think about this. And the president has a tough time. Today, I mean, Caroline, who was just on, got this exactly right. I was in the press room at the time, and this was like the one quote that jumped out at me. Almost everything there you could have scripted was when Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said that our objectives in Afghanistan are minimalist. Now, it isn't that this hasn't been said before, and he's not referring to an art style, but take a step back and say the president says we have to be in Afghanistan to protect ourselves for our national security's sake, and yet our objectives are minimalist. Those are two notions that are a bit at war with each other. You know, usually, as one of your earlier speakers said, we used to think of wars as gigantic, affairs in which there's a clear victory and a clear endpoint. Here we have minimalist objectives, which may actually, as Caroline also noted, may not be all that minimalist, and they aren't well defined. The public certainly, is lost, I would say, by this point in the conversation. They haven't followed it far enough to know what those objectives are, so they have no idea how to judge it, or in a lot of ways, I think, what to think about it. Now, this may work to Barack Obama's advantage. He's going to be up for an election, and the war won't be over. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction, as you mentioned earlier, amongst the Democratic base about this war. I think, we see anger over deals like the tax cut compromise the past week. And I think this is sort of a steady, sort of low volume, which is weird when you think about it, we're talking about a war, but sort of low volume background noise to Democratic dissatisfaction with Barack Obama. And I don't know anything he says today, anything he's going to do in July 2011 is going to change that picture much.
David Corin, Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. Harlan Ullman is a senior advisor to the Atlantic Council. That's a nonpartisan think tank that focuses on transatlantic issues. He's a distinguished senior fellow at the National Defense University, and he served in past as an advisor to both John McCain and John Kerry. Harlan Ullman, good to have you on our program.
Happy holidays, Warren.
Same to you. What about the politics of this? And if the Democratic base is disaffected, if American people in general are disengaged, where are the Republicans?
I wouldn't say that they're disengaged. They are on a pretty strong wicket because they're going to support President Obama, who would be against the war, who would be against our fighting men and women. And I think what you have to realize, way back in the early winter of 2009 when Obama entered office, his view of Afghanistan was cut and run. And that was not going to be practical. And I think it transformed itself into cut and walk. I know he was not happy with the review that took place and being forced, in essence, by the Department of Defense to have this surge. And I think now the NATO summit in Lisbon, which is set 2014 as the deadline date for NATO to be out and Afghanistan to be in fully, gives the president something of a bit of relief. But my guess is over the summer, Obama is going to start some kind of withdrawal because 2012 is going to be a fixation and obsession with everybody in Washington. And I think the Republicans will have a slight advantage because foreign policy outside a crisis or a catastrophe really doesn't weigh very heavily in our presidential elections usually, are going to say, look, we supported you in Afghanistan. Now you're cutting and walking and cutting and running, and they will use that against him. And in many ways, they will make common cause with some of the dissident Democrats. Having said that, and my own view about Afghanistan is entirely negative because I think what your other speakers have said lays out some of the contradictions. The biggest failing is Pakistan, that unless we get Pakistan right, which we will not, in my judgment, unless we do things differently, there is virtually no chance of being able to succeed, however you define it, in Afghanistan. But this time next year, everybody's going to be obsessed with jobs, employment, and the election, and I'm afraid that Afghanistan, Pakistan, and indeed Iraq, which is really off everybody's radar screen, will really be falling into into something that people are not going to be fully able to take on until after the elections, I'm afraid.
Harlan Ullman with the Atlantic Council. Still with us, Stephen Biddle with the Council on Foreign Relations. Do you agree that the president's initial feeling was a cut and run and that he's now changed it to cut and walk?
No. This president has tripled our troop count in Afghanistan. He campaigned on the idea that we would draw down in Iraq in order to increase our efforts in Afghanistan. Now, one can debate what the president's particular plan or expectation or willingness over a long period of time to sustain a high level of engagement would be. I think to some extent all those things are actually moving targets. But the idea that this president came in with the conception of cutting and running, cutting and walking, or cutting in anything in Afghanistan is, I think, radically at odds with the actual record of what the man said during the campaign. So I think one can debate what the appropriate way forward is. One can debate whether how much sacrifice over time the president is willing to make, but I think it's a substantial misinterpretation of the man's platform to believe that he wanted to disengage in Afghanistan.
David Korn, back to you. You use the term, David, disengaged to describe the American people. How long is that going to last, though, even if the economy is the main issue in the campaign, when we're spending $1 billion a year and people are dying?
You know, that's a really good question. I will admit that I have predicted wrongly over the course of the last couple of years that Afghanistan would become a political conflict, not just a military conflict, and I mean a political conflict back here at home. But, you know, you have increasing dissatisfaction with among House Democrats in Congress. You know, up to now, they haven't been willing to make too much of a stink about it, partly because with the number of Democrats who support the president and the Republican Party more or less supporting him on this point, it's not a winning battle for Democratic critics. So giving the president somewhat of the benefit of the doubt, they have been reluctant to make this a fight the way they, you know, did with, say, Iraq and President Bush. So they're not leading the way there. The American public, you know, is indeed more concerned, I presume, with jobs and the economy. I mean, yesterday, I believe, in the Daily Beast, Leslie Gelb, who used to be the president of the Council of Foreign Relations, had a column saying it's just ridiculous for us to be spending $125 billion a year in Afghanistan, where we should be using that money here at home to help people who are hard-pressed and to build our own schools and improve our own infrastructure, which is crumbling. And I think it's a marvelous talking point. I personally agree with it, but it's one that hasn't gotten much political traction yet. And I don't know if that's going to come to pass.
David Korn with Mother Jones Magazine, Harlan Ullman with the Atlantic Council, Stephen Biddle with the Council on Foreign Relations, Caroline Wadhams with the Center for American Progress. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. The producers of Which Way LA are Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Gary Scott. Managing producer Cameron Radziner. Technical director Mike Newport. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. You can email us and you can share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. You can also check us out on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.